Okay, so last time we were talking about the reader-writer problem. Okay, so just as a very quick recap, the reason you want to do a synchronization differently in some cases is the threads are trying to access a shared variable or a shared data structure in different ways. Okay, specifically in this case, there are two classes of threads. There are reader threads that only read the value of a variable, and then there are writer threads that modify the value. Okay. Protecting the shared variable with a global lock essentially is overkill. Okay. You are basically preventing more concurrency than you could achieve in this problem. So what you want is the ability to let multiple readers all read at the same time. Okay. Without one reader blocking another reader, but you want the writers to have mutually exclusive access to this variable. The writer writes, no one else gets to read or write. Okay, so we looked at how to do this. There are solutions that we have sort of gone through in class. Some favored readers, some favored writers. People didn't seem to understand it very well. From what I could see from your faces, it looked like just not making any sense. If you have questions, I can review it. The good news is you actually, when you use reader writers synchronization, you don't have to actually do all of this. What you have are special kinds of locks called read-write locks. Okay? So instead of just doing a lock.acquire, you will do lock.acquire in read mode or lock.acquire in write mode. And that automatically guarantees you this property. Okay? But what was useful here was to understand exactly how you actually do this internally. You have a question?
No, okay,
so that was readers and writers. There's one more synchronization problem that we will look at, which is called dining philosophers. Okay. The main difference between all of the ones we have looked at so far and this one is here there are multiple resources and you need to hold multiple resources in order to solve a problem. Okay. And that is essentially captured by this abstract notion of dining philosophers. So we'll go through this quickly and then we are going to do deadlocks for the rest of this class. Okay. So here is the problem. Okay. So it's sort of a very abstract representation of the problem. So you assume that there are five philosophers sitting around a table, okay, and they're eating or they want to eat spaghetti. Okay. And the assumption is you need two forks to do this. Okay. So you need, if you want to eat, you have to get your left fork and right fork and then you can eat. Okay. And as is shown in this picture, forks are shared. Okay. So you basically share a fork between your neighbors. Okay. Now each philosopher can be either thinking, in which case they don't care about eating at that point, or they become hungry. Okay, when they become hungry, they have to grab both forks, and only when they grab both forks can they eat. If they grab only one fork, they have to wait for the other one. If both are in use, they have to wait for both. Okay. So the synchronization problem is, if you want to eat, you become hungry, you first contend for this fork, and because you share your fork with your neighboring philosopher, you may not get it. It may be in use. It may not be free. In that case, you have to wait. Okay? But when both forks become free, then you actually grab both forks and only then you can eat. Okay? So the shared resource is a fork. Okay? And the reason this is interesting is it's not just, you're not contending for one resource, you want both. Only then you can make progress. If you have either the left one or the right one, that's as good as getting neither. So because you're not allowed to eat until you get both. Okay, yes.
Could a philosopher pick up one fork while he waits for the other one?
Yes, so we look at how do you solve this? Do you pick one and wait for the other one? Do you wait for both to become available? In what order to solve this? Your question.
Are you only allowed the left and right forks?
Yes, you are only allowed, the question is, are you only allowed left and right? So you basically can only grab the forks that are closest to you. You can't go and get somebody else's fork. Okay, that is also part of the problem. Okay, so it's not like grab two out of any five forks and start eating. So you have to basically, you're sharing your left fork with your neighbor and the right one with the right neighbor. Okay, so that's the problem. The reason it's interesting is thus far we only have a single shared variable or small single critical section. Here you need multiple resources at the same time to make progress. Okay, so here is a trivial or a very simple solution to the dining philosopher's problem. This one uses semaphores. Okay. So the fork is in this case called a chopstick, which is fine. So we'll assume that here this one has five philosophers. So we'll assume there's a lock on each of the, or a semaphore corresponding to each fork or a chopstick. Okay. So you basically try to grab the left one, that's chopstick I, you grab the right one, that's I plus one, try to grab a lock on both, and once you get a lock on both, and if either of this is not available, you would wait. Okay, that's what semaphore, this is your binary mutex semaphore, and then if you get both, then you are fine, you eat, and then you release both. Okay, so it's basically you are using binary semaphores or mutexes to do this. Okay, this seems like a reasonable solution. You grab your left one, you grab the grab a lock on the right one. When you have locks on both, you are done. Okay. So now question is, what does this solution do? Does it work? If not, what happens?
Yeah. It doesn't work because each philosopher could pick up their left chopstick, and then they're all holding the left chopstick, but so no one gets to eat ever because they never release it.
Okay.
They never get the right chopstick.
So what the point that is being made is, if each philosopher is essentially this executing this loop, if all philosophers, let's say, become hungry at the same time, could happen. Okay, maybe it's lunch time, and then each goes and grabs their left chopstick. Okay, since all chopsticks are initially available, everyone reaches for their left, they get their left. Now they try to reach to the right chopstick, and all the right chopsticks are gone because that's somebody else's left chopstick. Okay, so now you are just going to sit and wait forever. Okay, so this is a problem called deadlock. Okay, so this is something we are going to study in a few slides in quite some detail as to how to avoid this condition. Okay, so deadlock is a condition when you hold one resource, you are waiting for another resource. So in this case, each philosopher is holding their left chopstick, is waiting for the right chopstick, but the right chopstick is in use, and then basically no one makes progress because everyone is in the same state. So you are all deadlocked, waiting for somebody else to release their chopstick. Okay. So this problem, or this solution rather, suffers from a problem of deadlock. Okay. So you don't want to do this. You don't want to basically grab a lock on one and then wait for another one, and if that one is in use, and then you get into this trouble. Okay. So intuitively, what might one do to solve this problem?
You grab two chopsticks at once.
Okay.
Okay.
So it's not going to be enough to say let's try the right one first, because that doesn't work. The same problem. Okay. So you basically try to grab both. Yes.
After a certain amount of time, when you're holding the left one, if the right one's unavailable, you drop the left one.
Okay. So this is another solution. It says you wait for the right chopstick for some time. If it's not available, you release it. You could do that, but there is no guarantee that, like, you could basically have the same problem. Everyone picks up the left chopstick, waits for 5 minutes, right chopstick doesn't arrive, everyone puts it down. Now you grab the right chopstick, left one is gone. You wait for 5 minutes, you put it down. Okay, so you have the same problem, really. So only if you randomize the philosophers will this work. If they all become hungry and all try to contend for resources, we are basically in trouble. Not enough chopsticks to go around. Okay, so then let me go back to the comment that was made earlier, which was let's try to grab both or neither. Okay, so intuitively, you basically check, is my left and right, are they both available at the same time? If so, I grab them in a way that only if I get them, I get both, or I get nothing, I wait. So that is probably a better solution than getting one and then waiting for the other, which results in a deadlock. Okay, so that is sort of the basis for the solution that I'm going to show you. There's a lot of verbiage which you can basically ignore. This is your philosopher code. Okay, so basically when you're thinking, you do nothing. Here, when you take force, you're trying to grab both. In the previous case, you try to grab the left and the right in two different steps. Here, you basically get both, or you block. If at least one is in use or both are in use, you are going to block here. Okay, but only if both are available, you are going to proceed. Okay, once you grab both, you will eat, and then you will put both down at the same time. So the idea is you want to be able to grab both, or if any are in use, you will stop. And so the question is, how do you do this? Okay, so this is the code that I'll show you now. So that's basically the take fork method. Okay, and the really what it is doing is you grab a global lock. That's that mutex. Okay? So that means that if one philosopher is checking if a chopstick is available, nobody is even allowed to check. Okay? So the checks are protected by a global lock. That's that mutex, the first line there. Okay? And then what you do is you set your state to hungry. So you have been thinking, so you say now I'm hungry. That signals anyone that what's happening, and then you basically call this test. Test basically says check if both chopsticks are available, and if so, grab both. Okay, if they are not available, don't grab either one. Okay, that's basically what this test is going to do. Okay, so that's the test code right here. Okay, so what has happened here is what test is essentially doing is it's checking whether the left philosopher is eating and the right philosopher is eating. Okay? Or rather, the left philosopher is not eating and the right philosopher is not eating. Okay? My both neighbors, neither of them are eating, I know that my both chopsticks are available. Okay, so I check. So you are not looking at, you are just checking a flag here. Okay? This is not trying to grab a lock. So what each philosopher does is they also have a flag that says what are they doing at this moment. Okay, so you check, is the left neighbor eating? Is the right neighbor eating? If neither of those are eating, my both chopsticks are available. By definition, if they are not eating, they don't hold anything. Okay? So if you do this, then you can go ahead and eat because both chopsticks are available, so you basically set your state to eating. Okay? And if this is not true, test will just come out and then you will basically go and block here because it says block if the forks are not acquired. Okay, so the test is just checking for both. If only both are available, you grab both. If at least one is not available or both are in use, you do nothing. Okay, and then you come out and block. Okay, you will wait. So that's essentially the gist of the solution. Okay, there are some subtleties about if you are blocked, then how do you wake up eventually. Then the wake up happens when your neighbor actually puts their forks down. At that point they check. Okay, so this is, let's say you are blocked. At some point your neighbor is going to be done eating, because the only reason you are blocked is one of your neighbor is eating. Okay, so at that point you will check, the neighbor is going to check. Okay, saying are my either of my neighbors hungry? If so, let me give them the fork. Okay, so you basically call test for your left neighbor, test for your right neighbor, which basically re-executes the code that your neighbor had initially called and then puts you in the eating state if both forks are available. Okay, so I'm not going to go into a whole lot of details. The basic idea is you want to check to see both resources, or if you are trying to contend for n resources, what you don't want is to acquire these resources in some order and cause a deadlock. In this solution, you acquire all or you don't acquire any. Okay? If any one is in use, then you wait. Okay? And then at some point, if both become available, you will be woken up and you will be given those resources. Okay? That's the basic idea. So what, any questions on this? This is the picture here. Okay, this is easy to understand from this abstract thing because you sort of understand what you have to do. You have to wait until both of your neighbors are not eating, and then you both forks are available, you can grab. Either of them is eating, you wait. Go and grab anything. Any questions on dining philosophers? Is that clear? Yes, no? Okay, so there's a dining philosopher's version with monitors. Those are in the lecture notes. I'm just going to skip that because it's the exact same idea, just uses monitors instead of semaphores. Okay, but something that you can go look at as an exercise. Okay, so what I want to do is before I wrap up this discussion on synchronization and move on to deadlock, I wanted to provide some real world examples of where all of these problems that we have looked at, producer, consumer, reader, writers, dining philosophers, are actually used. Okay, so producer, consumer's example of this would be an audio video player. Okay, any video player, like if you have YouTube, is a good example. Okay, so there's a server, that's your producer, it's actually producing data and is streaming to you over a network. Your browser or the flash player that's embedded in your browser actually holds the buffer. Okay? So your video data is bits are coming over the network, they're getting deposited in this buffer. Okay? And the player actually that's running in your browser is the consumer. Yeah, that's an example of a single producer, single consumer problem. Okay. So you neither, if the buffer fills up, then the server needs to stop sending, because then you will overwrite data. Okay. If the buffer empties, your player will actually freeze, cannot display any more audio or video. Okay. Exactly what the producer and consumer does. Okay. If the buffer is neither empty nor full, the producer can keep sending and the consumer can keep consuming. That's essentially what flash player would do. Okay. Another producer and consumer is basically the how web servers are actually built. Okay. Web servers are built as multi-threaded apps. The way typically a web server like Apache web server works is there is typically what's called a master thread, and there are worker threads. Okay, and there's a buffer that sits between the master and the worker. Okay. All requests that are being sent to this website or this web server are arriving over a network. Okay. What the master does is essentially sticks them into this buffer. Okay. And each of these worker threads, as they become idle, they look into this queue or this buffer, and if there is a request waiting to be serviced, let's say you sent off an HTTP request, is waiting here to be serviced, it picks up that request and starts servicing it. It will fetch that web page for you and send it to you over the network. Okay. So this pool of worker threads are the consumers. This master that's sort of taking requests that are coming over the network would be the producer in this case. Okay, typically what happens in a web server is if this buffer fills up, the master doesn't really block, it sends an error to the browser saying the server is too busy. Okay, so try again later. Because there's no place to store any more requests. This buffer is typically large, when I store several thousand requests. The several thousand requests queued up, you start turning away requests. Okay, so there's a slight variant there, but it's essentially a producer-consumer example. Okay. So reader-writer, so if you think of any bank system or a bank database, there are processes or threads that may be reading records, like reading bank balance. As you go to an ATM and you check your balance, that's a reader. Okay, that process actually goes to the bank database and just reads your bank balance and it gives it back to you. And there are writers, so if you actually deposit money into your ATM or go to the bank and deposit money, then they update that record, that becomes a writer process. Okay? Now clearly any number of processes can read your bank balance at the same time, but if you are updating it, then you need an exclusive lock, so that becomes a writer. Okay, so that's an example, reader writers, dining philosophers, several examples. This one is probably easy to understand. You think of making a travel reservation. Okay, so the way if you are going on a trip, you want to make an airline booking, you want to book a hotel, maybe you want to get a rental car. Okay, and you want the trip reservation to succeed only if all three are available. Okay, the airline is sold out but a hotel is available, you don't want to make a hotel booking and wait for the hotel airline or something like that. If all of them are available, you basically go ahead and book the trip. If any one is not available, you basically either say wait for something to become available, or say something is not available, try some different date or a different airline or a different hotel or something like that. Okay? So this is a case where you are trying to make or get exclusive access on multiple databases. Okay? Each is essentially equivalent to a shared port. So the hotel records may be in a hotel reservation database, different from the airline database, which may be different from the car rental company's database. Okay, so you are trying to get access on everything and make sure you can get the trip or nothing. Okay? Those are some examples. Okay? There are several others. So here, dining philosophers is an example of as a problem that basically captures any cooperating processes that need multiple limited resources. Okay, so example, you can do backups the same way. Okay, so if you are back reading from disk and writing to tape, okay, you want to basically get a lock on both. This doesn't help if the disk is available, tape is busy, or tape is available, disk is busy. Okay, so you want to lock both, copy all of the data and release both. Okay, so some backup programs work this way as well. Okay, so these are some examples of how some of the synchronization problems appear in real world scenarios. Okay, so we have studied them in the abstract, but they occur again and again. Yeah, there's sort of no dearth of examples you can come up with that show where these are useful. Any questions or comments on this? Anything at all? Okay. So what I'm going to do now is actually go and talk about deadlocks in some more detail. We just saw an example of a deadlock where our version 1 of the dining philosopher's problem basically caused all the philosophers to basically hold your left chopstick and then block. Can never make any progress. Okay? This is clearly a bad scenario. You don't want this kind of scenario to occur in practice. Okay, so we are going to look at this in some more detail. So we'll start with a formal definition of what a deadlock is. Then we'll look at why deadlocks occur. And then we'll look at how to handle deadlocks. We'll look at what are called deadlock prevention techniques, deadlock detection techniques. Okay, so let's start with what's a deadlock. Okay, so here is yet another example, very similar to the dining philosopher's problem. Okay? So the formal definition of a deadlock is it's a condition where two or more threads are waiting or holding some resource and waiting for some other resource that's held by someone else. Okay? So they're waiting for an event that can be only generated by, so that's the formal definition. Here is an example to sort of understand how this works. So this is an example of a print job. Okay? The print job basically takes a lock on a disk. It takes a file from that disk and it sends it to the printer. Okay, and you want to lock the disk and you want to lock the printer in this case. Okay, so process A tries to grab the lock on the printer first and the disk next. And then it tries to copy the file from the disk to the printer and releases the lock. Process B, which also wants to process a print job, also grabs a lock on the disk and the printer, but in the other order. Okay, so here you grab a lock on the printer first and the disk next. Here you grab a lock on the disk first and the printer next. So it should be clear that this code can easily result in a deadlock because process A can probably, initially both locks are free. The process A might grab a lock on the printer, okay, and at the same time process B grabs a lock on the disk, and then when they make the next request, the disk is held by this process, the printer is held by that process, so now you are waiting for the other process to release and you are going to wait forever. Okay, neither of them will make progress. Okay, there is no way to solve this deadlock other than to reboot your system. Okay. So if you look at the definition, it says this is the condition where in this case there are two threads or processes in this case are waiting for an event to occur. The event is you release a lock. In this case, okay, release a lock that is held by some other process. Okay, is it clear what a deadlock is? Okay, it should be clear that this is not a good thing in your system if your threads are just waiting for something to happen and no thread is making progress, then your application essentially hangs. Okay, so this is like both processes here have hung waiting for something to happen, but nothing happens. Okay, so here's some terminology. We'll talk about this in a lot more detail. Okay, so when does deadlock occur? A deadlock will occur when multiple threads are competing for some finite number of resources all at the same time. Okay, if you have infinite number of resources, this would never occur. Okay, if each dining philosopher had access to infinite number of forks, there's no waiting involved. You always have the resource available, things are fine. Okay. So first, the number of resources that you are contending for have to be finite. The previous example, there were two, the disk and the printer. The dining philosopher, there were five forks. Okay, so there aren't enough forks to go around. Okay, so that's when deadlocks are going to occur. So how do you address this problem of deadlock? So there are two ways to do it. One is called deadlock prevention. The other one is called deadlock detection and avoidance. So in deadlock prevention, what you do is you do checks before you grant resource requests and prevent the deadlock from happening altogether. Okay, so when somebody makes a request, you check. If I were to give access to this resource or this lock to this process, could something bad happen down the road? The answer is yes. You say, I will refuse to give this this resource to you at this point and throw an error. Right? So you are preventing deadlocks. So you are being very conservative. You are doing extra checks beforehand, and then you prevent deadlocks from occurring altogether. That's one philosophy. You put some restrictions on the system. You do extra checks and you prevent this condition from occurring. Another way to deal with this is what's called deadlock detection. So in this case, you don't do a priori checks. Threads can do whatever they want. You try to detect after the fact, has a deadlock occurred, and you try to recover from it. Okay, so in this case, you let threads do whatever they want. You don't prevent them from doing anything. Okay, so here, you let mistakes happen and you basically recover from the mistakes. The previous case, you prevent the mistake from happening. You check, if you do this, could that lead to a mistake, which means a deadlock, and you prevent it. Okay, you say, no, I will not let you do this at this point. Okay. So these are the two broad category of techniques. Okay, and we look at mechanisms in each class. Okay, but before we do that, it's instructive to actually go and distinguish between a deadlock and starvation. Okay, so we have seen examples of starvation before. Okay. Shortest job first was, yes, your question.
I'm not sure if it's relevant, but what's a zombie process?
What?
Deadlocks or processes being killed?
Okay, so what is a zombie process? It has neither related to deadlock or starvation. A zombie process is a process that doesn't actually have a parent, okay, and it's basically waiting to be terminated. It's not terminated, just hung. In some bad state. Okay, that's called a zombie process. Yeah, so let's now come back to this and see what's the difference between a starvation and a deadlock. Okay? So just to recap, what is starvation? If you remember, shortest job first, scheduling. We said if there are long jobs and short jobs, it is a steady stream of short jobs arriving, you may make a long job wait forever. Okay? That is called starvation, but it's not deadlock. In both deadlock and starvation, some jobs are going to wait forever. Okay? So the real difference is in starvation, someone is making progress while someone else waits. Okay? In deadlock, no one is making progress, everyone waits. That's the main difference. Okay? In starvation, it's like some threads are starving but others are making progress. Right? In deadlocks, so everybody waits. Nobody can make progress. Okay, so that's the main difference. So you have to distinguish between the two. Okay, so understand what is starvation and what is deadlock. Okay, so we'll not talk about starvation here. We're only going to focus on deadlocks. Okay, so let's do a little bit of concepts and then we'll look at examples and solutions. Okay, so there are what are called four necessary conditions for deadlocks. So what that means is if there is a deadlock that has already occurred in your system, all of those conditions are true. Okay, so what are the conditions for deadlock? First is this, you need mutual exclusion. Okay, you need a scenario where there are threads that are trying to grab locks or semaphores or monitors or some such thing. There's no mutual exclusion, you cannot have a deadlock. Okay, so you need some form of synchronization, so which means some thread is holding a resource, etc. Okay, you need another condition to be true, which is, or another condition is true, which is called hold and wait. Okay? Hold and wait says that the thread is holding some resource and waiting for others. Okay, so it is clear that in a deadlock, both of the examples we were talking about, the dining philosophers, you are holding your left chopstick, waiting for the right. Okay, so you hold something, you wait for another. In the other example I just showed, you are either holding the lock on the disk, waiting for the printer, or vice versa. Okay, so you need this condition to be true. Okay? The third condition is what's called no preemption, which means you cannot force a thread to give up a lock. Okay, you can't preempt the lock or the semaphore. Okay, locks and semaphores can only be relinquished voluntarily. Okay, otherwise, you could just force somebody to give that lock to you. Okay, the left philosopher could say, I grabbed the fork from you and I'm going to eat. Okay, you don't allow that. Okay, so no preemption. The last one is the most interesting and the one that I think we'll look at in some detail, which is called circular wait. Okay, circular wait basically says each one is waiting for someone else and there is a loop that has occurred. Okay, so in the dining philosophers, okay, philosopher P1 was waiting for P2. P2 is basically waiting for P3 and so on. Okay, so you're basically a cycle that everyone is waiting for someone else and as a result you don't make any progress. Okay? In the other example I just showed you, there's a loop. Okay, process A is waiting for B and B is waiting for A. That's a cyclic circular wait condition. Okay? So that's really what causes deadlocks. If you have a cycle where you are waiting for someone else, someone is waiting for someone else, and then you have this loop, then nobody makes progress because each is waiting for somebody else to do something. No one can make progress. Okay. Now one thing to keep in mind, and this may not be clear why this is true right now, is these are what are called necessary conditions for deadlock. Okay, they are not sufficient conditions for deadlock. Okay, so what does that mean? It means that if all those conditions are true, that does not imply that there is a deadlock in the system. Okay, what this necessary condition says is if you know that a deadlock has occurred, then it's guaranteed that all those four conditions are going to be true. Okay, so it doesn't mean that if all those things are true, there is going to be a deadlock. But if a deadlock has occurred, then these are necessary conditions, and those conditions become true. Okay, and as we go through some examples, it will become clear why these are not sufficient conditions, okay, but only necessary conditions. Okay, so we are going to now look at deadlock detection. Okay, first. And then we'll look at deadlock prevention and avoidance. Okay, so basically what we want to now do is figure out when a deadlock has occurred. Okay? The canonical way to do this is to track which thread is holding what resources and see if there is some sort of a cycle that has occurred. Okay, is there basically hold and wait and a circular wait that has occurred. Okay, and if that is true, then you may assume that this can lead to a deadlock. So essentially the problem of detecting deadlocks is the same as the problem of detecting cycles in a graph. Anyone here taken 3.11? Okay, so you know how to do cycle detection in graphs. Here's an operating system problem that needs that theory. Okay, so if you haven't done 3.11, at some point you will do 3.11 and then you will learn how to do cycle detection. Okay, I'm not going to give you cycle detection algorithm, but I'll just show you the high level concept of how to go about doing this. Okay, so what is this graph that we want to detect cycles in? That's called a resource allocation graph. It is shown here. What the OS does is it basically keeps track of all the threads in the system, keeps track of all the important resources that are being allocated. And it keeps track of who is holding what resource and which thread is blocked on a lock or a semaphore for what other resource. Okay, and that is captured using this graph, and I'll show you what this edges mean. So here the circular nodes are threads. Okay, so there are four threads in this system. Okay, the square boxes are resources. Okay, we'll just number them. We don't care what they are. Could be disk, printer, whatever it is. We just give them numbers. Resource 1, resource 2, to capture the abstract notion of a resource. Okay, and this is a directed graph. Okay, so there are two types of edges. Edges going from threads to resources and edges going from resources to threads. Okay? And they mean different things. Okay? If you have a thread going from if you have an edge going from a thread to a resource, okay, that is essentially called an SI, that's called a request edge. Okay? Which means that this thread is requesting this resource, it wants this resource, doesn't have it yet. If you have a thread in the if an edge in the opposite direction, okay, from R to T3, that's an assignment edge. That means that that resource is currently allocated to this thread. Okay, this resource is basically held by that thread. Okay, so you will see here that there is actually a cycle because R3 is assigned to T2. T2 is waiting for R1. R1 is assigned to T3. T3 is waiting for R2, R2 is assigned to T4, T4 is waiting for R3, and there is a cycle here. Okay, so that's your graph. Okay, graph containing all these vertices, the edges basically result in a cycle. So if there is a cycle, a deadlock might exist. If you know that there are no cycles in this graph, you are guaranteed there is no deadlock. Okay, because cycle is a necessary condition for a deadlock. Okay, that also implies that if there is no cycle, there is no deadlock. Is that clear? Why? It's a logic. It's nothing to do with so because deadlock implies cycle. Okay, so no cycles implies no deadlocks. Okay, so you can, what the OS can do is periodically look at the resource allocation graph, run cycle detection algorithm. Okay, if you don't find any cycles, you know that there are no deadlocks because of this. Okay, no cycle implies no deadlock. If there is a cycle, because it's only a necessary but not sufficient condition, you know that this is a dangerous state, that that deadlock might exist. You don't know if there is one, but it might have happened. Okay, so you need to do something to prevent the system from going to that state. Okay, so essentially, so what do you, so if you have basically detected a cycle, what do you do? Okay, so there are only few things you can do. Okay, so to break, you want to basically break the cycle. Okay, there's too many words here, but the only important thing is there. Okay, so basically you need to detect cycles and break cycles. As soon as you have broken the cycle, you know that there is no longer a cycle, so hence there must not be any deadlock. So how do you go about breaking cycles? Request, there's nothing they can hold at that point. Okay? In the cycle. To go and say I'm going to terminate thread T2. You just kill. Yeah, as soon as you kill it, then there is no more a cycle because these two edges disappear from the graph. Okay, so you can kill all the threads, you can kill two of the threads. Yeah, or you don't kill the threads, but then you force them to give back a resource. Okay, so you don't delete nodes, you delete edges. Okay, the first two, which is kill all threads or kill one thread, essentially delete some of the nodes. So deleting the nodes, you can delete the edges. Okay, how do you delete the edges? If you have given a lock, lock is forcibly taken back from you. Okay, so the OS says lock is gone. Okay, I want to basically break this cycle. Okay, now clearly this is not something a programmer would expect. Okay, you don't expect that if your program is correct, that suddenly the OS comes and starts killing threads of your application. Right? Neither do you expect that if you are writing, let's say, your candy or Halloween candy problem, that you hold a semaphore, suddenly the OS says, I took the semaphore away. That's going to cause your code to go haywire. Because you are in a critical section doing something, suddenly lock is gone. Okay? So those are all solutions, but they don't really work in real scenarios because that's not how programmers will expect the system to behave. Okay, but if you want to break the cycle, you have to take these kinds of actions. Okay? So now typically most OSs, what do they do? They don't do any of this. Okay? If you wanted to do something about deadlocks, then you would have to run a cycle detector and you would have to take some actions whenever you detected cycles. Most operating systems says the programmer doesn't expect me to start killing their threads. Neither does the programmer expect me to go take their locks or semaphores back, so I don't worry about deadlock. Deadlock occurs, programmer's problem. You wrote bad code, you handle it. You can go reboot your machine, or if your application is hung, you kill the application. I'm not going to do it for you. That's the philosophy. So most operating systems, they leave it to the programmer or the application. So sometimes when you reboot, your machines are hung, there may actually be a deadlock on your machine, which is why everything seems hung. In some other cases, there may be other bugs, but sometimes deadlocks cause your system to hang. Okay? And then what do? You basically wait for some time, then you basically reboot. That's basically what operating system could have dealt with it and killed some process and could make the deadlock go away, but you don't expect that to happen. So the burden of doing this is now on the program. Okay, so that's basically, so these are all solutions, but the point is most operating systems don't implement them. That's not what you expect your system to do for you. Okay. Now there is something here about if you were to actually implement that, then how would you do it? Okay. How frequently would you run the cycle detector? When would you do this? Okay, so one way is you say I run it every 5 minutes or every hour. Okay, every hour I check the resource allocation graph. So things may be hung for up to an hour. If you run it every 5 minutes, things may be hung for up to 5 minutes. If you run it every 30 seconds, you may see a hang up to 30 seconds. Okay? So you have to pick a number. Okay? And cycle detection takes order n square times. So this is not a cheap algorithm. If you have lots of processes and lots of resources, yeah, this is going to take some CPU cycles to run. So the more frequently you run it, the more background work the OS has to do. Okay? So one is you do periodic on a regular schedule. Okay? The other one is you check whether cycles will occur just before somebody makes calls a lock acquire or semaphore wait. Then we'll see how to do that in just a little while. Okay? You could do this also if your CPU utilization drops. Okay? If you have lots of processes, but the utilization is, let's say, zero, you say something is wrong. There are all these processes, but no one is using the CPU. Okay? Maybe a deadlock has occurred. Okay, so then you run the cycle detector, saying, is there a cycle? Okay, and then so you could do that. Now, it may be that all of these processes are doing I.O., and that's the reason the CPU is not busy. They are all in wait state. Okay, but then you will still say, if CPU utilization is low, I will run the cycle detector. Okay, so there are many reasons or many triggers for when to run that, okay, the cycle detector, and take those actions. But the thing to keep in mind is doing this is expensive. Okay? Moreover, the programmer or user doesn't expect things to arbitrarily happen, that processes are being killed and resources are being taken away. So typically it's not done. Some systems, some very restricted forms of systems do this, but in any general purpose OS, you will not see this happen. Okay? So we look through some nice solution of doing deadlock detection using a graph and trying to detect cycles, but unfortunately we can't use it. So we'll have to find some other ways. Okay? Now let me give you another slide I just skipped here. I said that if the graph has no cycle, there is no deadlock. Okay, basically this condition. Okay, now I'm going to show you an example where there is a cycle in the graph and yet you can actually reason that this will not lead to a deadlock. Okay, this is why I said it's necessary but not a sufficient condition. Okay, so that's example is shown here. So there are two graphs here. This is the graph on the left and there's the graph on the right. It's a very small difference between the two. For now we'll ignore that. Let's focus on this graph. Okay. So what we have here now is there are two resources, or rather four resources, R1, R2, R3, R4, but there are multiple types of certain resources. There are two instances of R3, three instances of R4. Okay. Think of this resource like a bank of printers. Okay. So when you send a print job, you don't particularly care whether it goes on this printer or that printer, any printer will do. Okay, so there are sometimes resources that have multiple instances and any one of those will do. Okay? So we now have a generalization of a resource allocation graph. The circles are still threads, okay, but there may be multiple types of a resource. And when you say I want R3, okay, one instance of R3, you don't care which one you get. Okay? So that's something to keep in mind. Okay? Now you will see that this graph has a cycle. Okay? Because the cycle is basically R3 is allocated to T2, T2 wants R1, but R1 is held by T3, T3 holds R2 or wants R2, R2 has been given to T4, and then there is a cycle here. Okay? So you might say this is bad, so let's start terminating some threads and so on. Okay? But here on the right you will see an example where the same loop exists. But you can reason that there is no reason that this will not lead to a deadlock. Okay, so the only difference that we have between this and this is we have added one more instance of R3, another three instances of resource R3, and then one of them is allocated to T1, which is not part of the cycle. Okay, that cycle still exists, so that cycle basically is this one. So R3 to T2, T2 R1, so you basically go and do this. So now you might ask, so what did we do? What does this achieve? Why is there no deadlock? Yes.
Because not every thread is waiting.
Okay, not every thread is waiting. That's true. Good point. Now, which one is not waiting? T1 is not waiting. Okay, so that's good. So what will that do for us? You're on the right track, but follow through. Okay, so T1 is not waiting on anything. It currently holds R3. Maybe R3 is a bank of printers. Okay? So T1 is holding printer, one instance of the printer is printing a job. At some point that task will be done. Okay? So now thread doesn't need this resource anymore. It will relinquish it, it will release the lock on that resource. This instance of R3 will become free. Okay? Now if you have a free instance of R3, then you can actually break that cycle by just allocating this R3 to one of the threads, namely thread T4 is waiting for R3. So just allocate that to T4, this edge will flip. A request edge becomes an assignment edge. Because you are waiting for a printer, now you have the printer, the edge flips, the cycle is gone. Okay, with the cycle you need directed graph with all the edges pointing in the right direction. Okay, so now what does this tell us? I mean, this is just looks like a very contrived example. Okay, but this example is showing an important property. And the property is, it says that even though there is a cycle in this graph, in this particular example, you can show that a deadlock will not occur. Because eventually this resource will become free, because T3 was not waiting for anyone, it was just holding and not doing any wait. Okay, that resource can be allocated to one of the threads that is part of the cycle, and by doing that you have just broken the cycle. Okay, so this is why those conditions are necessary but not sufficient. Okay, because you might have a cycle in the graph. Okay, basically a circular wait, your hold and wait, etc. But yet there is no deadlock because there are multiple instances of resources and you can allocate them in certain ways. Okay, so that's the reason or sort of the small insight behind why cycles don't necessarily mean deadlocks. Okay, no cycles basically no deadlock. Deadlock means cycle, but cycle doesn't. So this is not true. Okay, so this implication is true, but this one is not true. That's what we just showed. There was a cycle, but that did not imply a deadlock. Okay. So now, what other things can we do about deadlocks? Okay, this thing didn't work for us. Okay, so now let's see, can you even prevent this from happening in the first place? Okay, so we said that the cycle detector was after the fact. You say let the threads do whatever they want and you will check after the fact, has something bad happened, has there been a mistake, you try to correct for it. The other way is, as I said, you do deadlock prevention. You don't allow the system to go into any state where there could even be a possibility of a deadlock. So how could you do that? I said these are the four necessary conditions for a deadlock. So what does this mean? If there is a deadlock, then all of those four conditions is true. So now you redesign your system so that one of those four conditions is always false. Doesn't matter what's happening in the system, you are going to do some extra checks, you are going to put some restrictions so that one of those four, any one, is always false. One of those four is false, by definition deadlocks cannot occur. Because if deadlocks occur, all those four have to be true. But you have made sure that one of them will always stay false. So no matter what the threads do, whatever your code does, you will never have a deadlock. Okay, yes, question.
So
So then the easiest one to break would be mutual exclusion just by...
Yeah, we'll come to which one is the right one to break, but I'm just... Okay. Yes, so we'll look at what happens if you make each of them false. And that's a good design for your system. But is the high level idea clear what we are going to do? We are going to make one of these false. By doing so, we prevent a deadlock, because these are necessary conditions, and a deadlock implies all of those would be true. Since one is false, you can never have a deadlock. So conceptually, what does this mean? You want to take each one and make it false. Okay, the first one is mutual exclusion. Okay, we'll say there can never be any mutual exclusion. What this means is that we will basically delete the lock, semaphore, monitor libraries from your machine. So if you can never request a lock or a semaphore, by definition there will never be a deadlock. Okay, so you cannot do synchronization anymore. Okay, so then nothing is going to wait. Okay. Clearly, this is not a good design decision, but if you wanted mutual exclusion to be false, then you say, I don't support locks. So you cannot wait. You cannot wait. There's nothing to request. Okay? So as you can see, I mean, that's not a good design decision, but that's one that will work. If you don't have locks, there is no deadlocks to begin with. There's nothing to deadlock on. So that's one thing. So what that says, I mean, the other oblique way of saying that is you make resources shareable, not mutually exclusive, meaning that multiple threads can access them at the same time, essentially meaning you don't have to grab a lock to access that resource. Essentially the same thing. So another one here says you basically make hold and wait false all the time. So that's a potential solution. What that says is essentially what we did for the dining philosophers. In dining philosophers, version 1 of the solution says, I hold my left chopstick and I wait for the right chopstick. That led to a deadlock. And we said that's a bad solution. What we will do is it will be all or nothing. You grab both or you grab nothing. That works. Okay, so you either hold everything and wait for nothing, or you wait for everything and hold nothing. If you do that, then hold and wait will never become true, because you can either only hold or you can only wait, but you can never hold something and wait for something else. Okay? So how did we do dining philosopher? That's the same thing we will do here. We say that you either declare and grab all the locks you want all at once, or you wait for all the locks to be available, and you can't hold some locks and wait for the others. Okay? So basically you say you are now restricted from writing your application in the following way. Whenever you start, you hold, grab all the locks. So you either get everything or you wait for them all to become available. So hold nothing, but you wait. That's essentially what the dining philosophers think. But now you have put a restriction on the programmer. Think, thou shall not write certain types of code. If you write synchronization code, this is the only way you can write it. Grab everything and release everything, or wait if something is in use. Okay? But that's a fine solution. It just says that we have put some restrictions on how programs will be written in the system. Okay, so then you made hold and wait basically will always be false, because you're always either holding, you're always waiting, but never doing both at the same time and causing problems. Okay? So all of this will come with some trade-offs. Okay, you'll put some restrictions. The first one says you can't even use locks. That's not a good solution. Here at least you can write synchronization programs, but not any arbitrary ones. Okay, you have to basically make the threads request all the resources they need at once. Okay. The next one is no preemption. Okay, so in this case, you basically say, I will allow the OS to take back a lock it has granted. Okay, then you basically run your cycle detector and you take a lock back. Okay, problem is solved. Okay, but again, that's not a good solution, because you assume in your program that once you hold a lock, you keep holding it until you release it. You don't expect that the lock is forcibly taken away from you. Okay? So you can make no preemption be always false, but again, that's not a good solution. Last one is saying, let's make circular wait be always false. You can never have a circular wait. Okay, you will basically put a restriction on the programmer, which says circular wait can never occur in your system. Okay? And the way you can do this is you basically impose an order in which resources will get accessed. Okay. And I'll show you an example of how to do that, but before I do that, let me go back to this solution. And you can say, how do you trivially remove circular weight here? How do you make this code actually work? And have no deadlocks. Yes?
You switch process B to have printer.weight and then this.weight.
Okay. So here the solution that is being proposed is you flip these two statements. Okay, does that get rid of deadlocks? Yes, no. Yes. Okay. So clearly in this case what will happen is you always say you must always get the printer lock first and the disk lock next. Okay, everybody must do it in that order and that order only. If you violate that order like that process did, then you will have trouble. So what does that do? So it basically says get the printer lock first. Okay, so if process A got the printer lock, process B is basically going to block on the first statement. Cannot even proceed. Okay. So in this particular case, by just flipping this and imposing the order, saying always get the disk printer lock before you get the disk lock, you have removed the deadlock from this code. Okay. Now it turns out this solution actually works more generally. And that's what was basically mentioned here. So what it says is always impose an order in which if you basically request locks on resources. So one way to do this is you take all the resources in your system, you number them 1 through n. Okay, so you give everything a unique integer number. And if you need any subset of those, you always get the request a lock on the least one first and the next one and the next one in that order. And that will prevent circular weight. Okay, why does that prevent circular weight? So you're saying that you will never have circular weight because you've broken a link. Let's try to understand what link and why. That's true. Okay, so okay, so here is an example of circular weight. There are three threads, T1, T2, T3, some arbitrary resources, resource 10, resource 15, resource 17. This is a resource allocation graph. Here there is a cycle. Okay. So what does this cycle say? It says that T3 is holding resource 17 and it is asking for resource 10. Okay. So what does that mean in the code? In code for T3, you have basically said resource 17 dot lock or lock for resource 17 that acquire, then subsequently you are trying to I'll just say resource 17 dot lock resource 10 dot lock. Okay, the only way this condition will be true is if T3 first grabs a lock on 17 and then a lock on 10. Okay, so this is basically the order in which locks have to be requested in the code for T3. Okay, now if you impose an ordering, this should never occur. Okay, because you should have always asked for the lock on 10 before you ask for the lock on 17. Because that's the order in which you request locks, because you have numbered resources and you acquire locks in increasing order of their IDs. Okay, yes, your question?
No, sorry.
Okay, so by just flipping this statements, you will actually prevent that from happening. Okay, the same thing happened in that example of our printer and the disk. Okay, basically, you had something waiting on the printer, and you said that by just flipping that order, this got rid of it. So you never have this thing going back because you have a circular weight. You just break this last edge because you could have never done this. You should have actually held this first before you even requested it. So just by imposing this order, okay, you can get rid of it. Now this is also a feasible solution. Okay, you basically tell the programmer that resources are numbered. If you write proper code, not buggy code, then this condition will never be true. Is that clear? Okay. So now what we are actually going to see is a technique that essentially does this. So this is a technique where you basically try to request all of those resources and declare what's happening, and then we'll try to see how you can prevent deadlock connection. Okay, so this is deadlock prevention with what is called resource reservation. Okay, so I'm best shown by the example. Okay, so here what is going to happen is there will be some number of threads. Okay, those threads will declare upfront at startup time what are all the resources they are going to request during the execution. Okay, so you declare to the OS saying these are all the locks I can acquire during the execution. So the OS will have this information. Typically you don't do this. Okay, when you write your code, your program doesn't tell the OS what semaphores or locks you can acquire. Okay, but we will assume that threads are going to declare this to the OS, so the OS knows precisely what things can be acquired. Okay, and every time you actually send in a new acquire request, you are going to do some checks to see that if that can result in a problem. If that will result in a problem, you will deny that request. You won't even let it. And if not, you will let it. Okay, so there are two things, two concepts to remember. What is called a safe state of the system and an unsafe state. Okay? A safe state is one in which you are sure that a deadlock will not occur. An unsafe state is one in which you know that if you go to that state, you will actually give this resource to that thread, then a deadlock might occur. Okay? Now, what's a safe and what's unsafe? It can be best illustrated with this example. Okay? So here is a very simple example where there are three threads, T1, T2 and T3. Okay? So there are threads that are competing for 12 tape drives. Okay? So tape drives are the resources, the threads are the ones that are competing for them. Okay? This might be, the threads may be running backup programs and they are dumping files to a tape. Okay? That's a simple scenario. Okay? So what each thread has to do is when it starts up, it has to declare what is the maximum number of tape drives it might actually need over the execution of the program. Okay, so in this case, T1 says it could potentially need up to 4 tape drives concurrently. Okay, it might need to write to 4 tape drives. T2 says it might need 8. T3 says it might need 12. Okay, so that's the max need column. And then what's the maximum number of resources you might need? Okay, the in-use column says how many of those resources are currently allocated to each of these threads. Okay, so here, this says 3 tapes are currently allocated to T1, 4 to T2, 4 to T3. Okay. Could want is how many more could you request? Okay, where is that coming from? Okay, so if you could ask for 4, you are already holding 3, how many more could you want? So this is basically the difference between these two. Okay, so this you declare, this is the current state of the system. So OS can basically easily figure out how many more could you want. Okay, but we'll just put that in a column. That's basically the difference between max minus in use is the how many more resources are you allowed to request based on what you told the OS. Okay. So now what we are going to do is reason about is this a safe state or not. Okay? So what does that mean? So it means that regardless of what these threads could do from this point on, you will never get into a deadlock. If that is true, then you are in a safe state. Okay? So what is the worst that these threads can do? Okay, the worst possible scenario is all of these threads ask for whatever more they could want all at the same time. Okay, so thread 1 says I want one more tape drive, thread 2 says I want 4 more, and thread 3 says I want 8 more. Okay, that's the worst possible or the resource allocation request the OS could receive. Okay? So even in this worst case where resources are constrained, if you could satisfy all the threads' needs in some order, then you know that you will not have a deadlock. Otherwise, each thread is holding some tape drives and asking for some more. So you might get into hold and wait, and then you will basically deadlock. Okay? So now question is, if you have a total of 12 tape drives, and each thread then goes and asks for these many more, is that safe or unsafe? Will that result in a deadlock? Okay, so you need to understand what you could do to prevent a deadlock. Okay, so how do you do this? First, we have to understand how many tape drives are free, they are idle. Okay, so how many do we have? We have 12. These are the ones currently allocated. Okay, so 11 are currently in use. Okay, so one tape drive is free. Yeah, because there are 12 tape drives, 3 are in use. Rather, 11 are in use. Okay. So now if each thread comes and says it wants these many more, what could we possibly do? We have one tape drive to give out. Okay. T1 can ask for one more. So let's give that tape to T1. Okay, that's the only thing it could ask for. So T1 gets whatever it needs, okay, and eventually it will finish, because there is nothing more that will cause it to wait. It asked for it max, it got whatever it wanted, it's happy, it will compute, it will finish. When it finishes, it will release these 4, okay, that it's holding. Okay, so now we see what can we do with those 4. Okay, we can give it to T2, which has asked for 4 more. Okay, so you just freed up 4 drives, T2 wants 4 more, you give those 4 to T2. Okay, so T2 gets its 8, there's nothing more it can ask. It is happy, it will compute, it will finish. And then it will release all the 8 that it was holding. Okay? You take those 8 and you give them to T3. T3 gets its maximum, T3 will finish. Okay? So we just found a sequence in which you could make this worst case request sequence and yet get all the threads to finish. Okay, so that says that this is a safe state, because there is an order in which the threads can execute and finish, and hence not result in a deadlock. Okay, so just to make contrast that with what is now an unsafe state, so it says if T3 requests one more tape drive, okay, the question is now will that state become safe or unsafe, and then the answer is it is going to be unsafe for the following reason. So if T3 requests one more tape drive, this is the condition. Okay, so this row went from 12.48 to 12.58. Okay, so that's basically what has happened here. Okay, now you have to reason the same way. Okay, is this a safe state or not? And then you say, how do you do that? You say all threads will request their worst case. Thread 1 will say, I want one more. T2 will say, I want 4 more. T3 will say, I want 7 more. Okay, and you say, is there any way for us to satisfy those requests in some order, doesn't matter what, and make these threads finish? No. Okay, so clearly, there are, since all of the threads, tape drives are in use, all 12 are in use, if any thread asks for any more, there's nothing you can do. So in the worst case, if all of them come and ask for some more, they'll all wait for some other thread to finish and release, because there's nothing more to give out. Okay, so that could be a potential deadlock. So that says that this is an unsafe state. Doesn't mean that the deadlock has occurred, but there's a possibility of a deadlock. And we don't even want to go there. Okay? So what you will, the only way you can not go here is if T3 requests one more tape drive, you tell T3, that puts the system in an unsafe state, so I'm not going to grant you that request. You throw an error saying this will lead you to an unsafe state, so you deny that request, so you stay in the previous state. Okay, so you will basically not even do that. Okay. So the algorithm basically checks the system state. As request comes in, it says if I grant this request, it puts the system into this state. Is the state safe or unsafe? If it is safe, you grant that request. If it's unsafe, you deny that request. Okay, that's the basic idea. Right. So we will come back to this and do it more formally. This was just the solution using examples. Okay, there's a formal definition of this, or not definition, but description of this using the allocation graph, and there's something called the banker's algorithm, which we will talk about next time. Okay, so we'll see how to do this example that I just sketched out using our graph. Okay, what graph algorithm are we going to use there is what we'll check. Okay, so let's stop here for today. If you came in late, there's an announcement I made saying exam 1 is the midterm, is going to be held on November 3rd. It's an evening exam. Okay. It's going to be held from 7 to 8:30. It's going to be in CS 142. I put a note about this on the course schedule. Okay, if you go to the web page, look at the lectures page, you will see a note. Okay, just keep that in mind. That's all exams will be closed books, closed notes. Okay? Not just inside.